get started, I think our problem will be one of time, so I think it would be useful if we got started. I'm Alina Morris, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. I'm the president of the Individual Development Center in Seattle, which is a counseling service for adults that are facing career or personal decisions. And this was a center that got started back in 72 because I really felt that our society had a gap in its services. That is, it seemed as though if you were healthy, you were supposed to not need any help. And then if you were sick, you were supposed to need all the help that the society could provide. And my feeling was that good, strong people went through periods in their life when they needed just a little bit of help. And my observation was that some of our very best people, some of our most talented people, some of the people that had an incredible kind of potential, were the ones that didn't get the help. It was almost assumed that they should be able to figure out their lives themselves and they should be able to carry on. And yet I found that the more talented people were, the more the options they had, and in fact, life was more complicated for them because they had a lot of things they could do, and trying to sort those things out was often very difficult. So it's been fun to see that working now for the last 11 years. And it was one of those things where you just decide you have to get it done, and there was no financial help, so we thought, well, we'll do it without any financial backing, and it has worked just very well. That way you keep your independence also, which I'm all for. So I would like to talk to you a little bit today about a concept of life planning that our clients find quite useful. I was just talking to the people earlier, and I said that if some of the people who are working here at Holden would like me to do a seminar on honest-to-goodness resume writing, how to do this and how to market your skills, I will be happy to do that at another time this week, because that is something I do for people all the time, and it might be something that some of you need right now. But I'm not going to be doing that kind of thing today. I would like instead to talk about a way of looking at your life and a way of planning for the future. Because we are really in such a different space now. I can remember when I was talking about getting this center started, people said, well, why do you need to counsel people just on planning their life? Shouldn't they be able to do this for themselves? And I said, well, in simpler times they could, but things have changed radically. And one of the radical changes is that we are expected to move into many different careers in a lifetime. It used to be that if you made a halfway decent decision when you were somewhere between 18 and 22, you could reasonably expect to hang in with that as long as you kept your nose clean and didn't rock the boat and didn't upset people. I mean, as long as you were fairly productive, you could keep going with that career for a lifetime. But that isn't the way it works anymore. I don't even think it was a terribly good way, but now, even if you wanted to, you couldn't. I can remember when I was reading Toffler back in 1970, when he commented that you really should expect to go through 7 major life changes. I thought, oh my goodness, surely not. But I find people now going through many more than 7. They're having to really look at their life periodically and saying, given what has happened in the society and given what has happened to me, what do I do next? Because the change is so rapid out in the society that they have to, and just in terms of economic need. In fact, I just finished doing a lot of work with the Weyerhaeuser Company on the people who they've had to let go because of the timber industry problems. People who have been with the company for years and who are good workers, the company did not want to have to let them go, but they had to, and they've treated them very decently. As such things go, they've given them outplacement services, as they call it. But every one of those people that I talk to say, I never expected this. And that's that sense of almost being betrayed by change. And I think that this is really what we're dealing with, is that life is no longer predictable, even if, I guess it never has been, but it is getting even less so, even on some of the rather superficial dimensions. And I know very well when this really came home to me. And I was living over in Borneo, where my husband was a pastor with the Chinese church there. He was an assistant to the bishop. And I was heading up a Chinese high school. And I was working full time and going full speed, and I was getting tired. And I was hitting a time in my life when I was coming close to 40, and I got a letter from my mother. And this letter said, "Your Aunt Haldora in Iceland is now 94 years old." And then it was the next line that scared me. She said, "You know, the women in our family do tend to go on and on." And I can remember sitting there in the Land Rover in the heat, and I did a little bit of math, and I said, 94 minus 39, and I came up with 55. And I can remember thinking, you know, I have no idea what to do with those years, because I had already lived my script. I had gone to St. Olaf and graduated like a good girl should, and I got married, and I had four children, and I taught music for 3-4 years, and you know, all the things that one should do. And here I was at 39, and I had played out that script. And now my mother was implying that I could have 55 more. And on one hand, I thought that was nice, but I had no idea what I wanted to do with it, so it looked like a drag. I mean, just hanging around for 55 minutes did not interest me. Well, I want you to know that 2 years ago, that aunt died at 108.
Oh. Yeah, she still has.
I can remember looking at that and thinking, you know, I'm not making much headway. The only good thing about it is that 2 years before she died, I decided to get over there and talk with her and visit with her, and discovered that she was still very sharp. She was still very alert, very active. Her wit was becoming more acidic with each passing day, and she was sort of a general terror, but she was not dull. And what was fascinating to me was to talk with her and try and discover, how do you live well for such a extended lifespan? Because that is one of the number one changes that we're having to deal with, is that we are really moving into a time when it is very reasonable to consider living to 70, perhaps even 80. And just the life expectancy for people in general in our country, it's up to about 77, 78, and it is really rather mind-boggling. Because it's not a virtue, you see, unless you have some idea of what to do with it. And the old way of thinking about life planning, the kind of thinking that was basically still going on when I went back to graduate school at the age of 40, I was surprised to find that the studies in human development were still concentrating heavily on child development and adolescent development. The idea was still very much there that if you were raised right, you know, if people had done the right things with you when you were a kid, and if you had been treated right in your high school years, your adolescent years, that somewhere along the age of 21, you were supposed to be an adult, and you were supposed to know what you wanted to do. And then if all this had come about in a proper way, it would look sort of like this, where I call it the industrial model of adult development, in which you pay attention to the product, you do child development and adolescent development, and you know that as well as I do. You go to the universities, and they've just got books ad nauseum on this stage of life. And then you hit 21, and then if you've done this part well, then you're supposed to carry on until 65, or, you know, Reagan will let not go to 70 now, and then you're supposed to peter out as gracefully as possible and get off the stage. That's basically the message. And I sort of had this sense, and I think that's why I was so frightened by it. And then to heighten that was about 6 months before we were to leave Borneo, we got a telephone call from the Swedish-American line representative there in the town of Kota Kinabalu, and he said, "You're our only Americans around here, and we are going to, for the first time, have a big liner come into town, the Kungsholm." And he said, "They can't actually dock because we don't have a deep enough port, but they're going to be out a ways, and we'd like to take the you people, the only American family we've got, out there by launch, and encourage the people to come on shore, because they're afraid that Borneo, you know, all they've ever heard about is the wild man of Borneo, and they're not too anxious to come on shore," which I thought was good sense. And, but at any rate, he said, we'll take you out there. Because he said, we understand that of the 600 people on board, most of them are Americans. So we went out there, these four kids and my husband and I, and we got on there, and sure enough, it was overwhelmingly Americans, it was overwhelmingly American women, and it was overwhelmingly American women over the age of 50. And I started talking with them as the kids went running around the ship to explore everything. And I tried very hard to get a good conversation going because we'd been away from home for a long time and I kept saying to them, well, tell us the news. You know, what's going on back at home? We've heard there was a big brouhaha with the Democrats and in Chicago. What really went on? And this woman said, well, I don't like to talk too much about those kind of things. You know, when it comes on the TV, I just think, like, who needs it? So I turned it off. Can't do anything about it anyway. And I talked to another one, and I said, what is going on back home? You know, what are people thinking about the Vietnam War? And she said, you know, I just think that's terrible. My son was telling me and talking about it at dinner last Sunday, and I said, you know, you're really spoiling a good meal. And I tried very hard to get some good, vigorous conversation going with those people, and they weren't with it. And they were not wicked. I had the strong feeling they were very, quote, good people. And they were not dull. They were well educated, and they had plenty of time, obviously. This was a 90-day cruise. They had money, it was expensive. But I couldn't get anything going until they started to talk about the crack in the shuffleboard. Now that was worth getting excited about. And I got a very uncomfortable feeling in the gut of my stomach. I thought, there goes my future. Because I could be like that. And I thought, how does this happen? Because nobody intended it to be this way. And I was just truly distressed and nauseated, genuinely, and I was standing waiting for the launch to come back because I wanted to get off there. Because I really felt that there was something wrong here. And I had what would be called a powerful religious experience in which I could hear the first part of Genesis in which God tells Abraham, you have been blessed to be a blessing. Mm-hmm. And I had this strong feeling that these people had every blessing in the world. And they wanted to be a blessing. They just had no idea that they were needed, and they had no idea what to do about the fact that they were seen as bystanders, onlookers, sort of outside the mainstream of the decision-making of the country. They really felt they had no impact, they had no power. They saw themselves as sort of over the hill. They saw themselves as not making an impact, and they didn't see themselves as having any future. In fact, I said to one woman, I said, what are you doing back in the States? And she said, beg your pardon? I said, what do you do back in the States? And she said, well, when the ship docks in New York, I'm going to visit my daughter. But, you know, she's in a very small apartment, so I don't want to be in the way. So I'm going to take another tour around the Mediterranean. I thought, dear God, you know, she's been floating for 9 days. She doesn't want to be in the way. Listen to that phrase. In the way. And this was a woman with a master's degree in English from the University of Minnesota. But she wanted to stay out of the way. Well, I don't think this is unusual. And I still see it as sort of a pattern of behavior. And what happens, I think, is that we feel as though life goes on in sort of a static way here, and then when we see it coming to the accepted time of getting off the stage, we don't know what to do about this. And I'd like to propose to you that this is a very bad model of how people really live, because I haven't experienced it that way. And I don't think most of us do if we really look at how our lives go. I think that more, it's like this. That the way it happens is that somewhere around the age of 18 to 22, most of us make our basic life decisions. It doesn't mean to say that we're going to stick with them, but we have to make some kind of decisions because everybody's pushing us to do it. You know, what are you going to major in? What are you going to finish up in? You know, what are you going to do for a career? Who are you going to become a partner with? What are you going to, where are you going to live? I mean, we just get pushed into decision making at this time, and it's a very hard time for most people. But one way or the other, most of us make the decisions because we have no options. And we use the 20s usually as a kind of experimentation and trying out different things. Then what we discover is that somewhere around the end of the 20s and into the early 30s, and we certainly see our clients coming in a big cluster at that time, people come in and say, you know, I feel as though I'm going through an ending. I feel as though there's a part of my life that is just no longer satisfying. There's really nothing particularly wrong. It's just that I sense a need to reassess what's going on in my life. And they talk about being depressed. And as they talk, you can really hear a kind of pattern of behaviors and a pattern of feelings that really announce the need for a life reassessment. And these kind of symptoms, or if you want to call them that, because I don't think they are pathology by any means, but the kinds of things that you hear are that I am restless, I'm bored, I'm very indecisive, I am just want to get away and do something else, but I don't know what. And in fact, as you listen to them, what you're really hearing is that this season of their life has really started to end. And there's a kind of actual dying involved. There's a feeling that who they were is no longer valid for the future. And they're really saying, who I was and the way the world was is already coming to an end of some sort, but that's not appropriate because here I am only 30 or 31. So this doesn't make sense, and many times they say, you know, I feel a little crazy. So it's quite helpful sometimes to just simply say to them, actually, the fact that you're feeling this way is an echo of how you felt back between 18, 22, 25 in that period. It's really what Augustine called divine discontent. That is, you respect yourself enough and are enough in touch with yourself so that you realize at some intuitive level that you need to redesign your realities because you've changed and the world has changed. And what you really have to do is to go through some pain here. And I'm just going to talk a little bit more about that, but I want you to know that we see it in our clients again. Somewhere around in the late 30s, early 40s, and I'm here to testify that it happens again around 50. And I have an awful feeling that it goes on about every 7 to 10 years. In fact, the Chinese and said Confucius insisted that people's lives go in 10-year periods. And even when he he lived 600 years before Christ, he said you should live the proper length of life was 70, even as the Hebrews insisted that it was 70, and even as the Greeks insisted that it was 70, even though the actual lifespan about the time they were talking was right around 30. But they still saw 70 as the ideal. But the Greeks thought that it was 10 sevens, and the Chinese thought it was 7 tens. I don't care which one you like. All I know is there is no chronological absolute here at all because everybody's life is very unique and very different in its patterns. But there does seem to be sort of a rhythm. And what I think happens is that we go through these periods of ending that are painful, psychologically painful. And what it is a signal that you need new decision making. It means that you have to say, who am I now? But for many of us, the pain scares us. We don't recognize the need to go through pain. Because in our culture, we have seen pain as bad. We've never been taught that pain is a necessary good. And yet I see in my clients that I have to sort of let them feel the pain. The worst thing I can do is to try to protect them from their own struggle, to trivialize it, or to ignore it, or to pretend that it isn't a signal for an important new growth leap. What happens is that people go through a lot of turmoil and pain. And the word that I like to use for this decision time is the old Greek word chaos. And chaos, you know, does not mean turmoil, really. It means nothingness. Its real meaning is nothingness. It means that the old has ended, but the new is not yet in place. People don't express it that way. They say, you know, Mrs. Morris, I can tell you one thing. I know what I don't want. It's just that I don't know what I do want. They're very aware of what has ended, but they have not yet been able to determine the little green shoots of what is yet to come. And I have to say to them, out of chaos is creation born. You have to experience this nothingness so that your spirit can be open to what is to be. So you need to learn to be sensitive and alert and awake to what is being said to you for your next life stage. To be really paying attention to what God is trying to tell you about your gifts and your talents and your potential and your possibilities. But I find it very distressing to work with people from this standpoint, that many of our very best people have been trained not to think in terms of their strengths and their potential and their possibilities, but instead have been very carefully trained not to celebrate their strengths. So to try and get them to articulate and tell you all the good things about themselves and all the marvelous things that they would be capable of doing, I have to pull it out of them as though I were pulling teeth. And I didn't really understand this until I became a consultant to about 20 different orders of Catholic sisters. And I'll never forget the time I had a room full of major superiors, you know, the heads of orders. And these marvelous women were sitting there, and I was talking to them about the need to be able to articulate their strengths. And I said, just for the fun of it, take your piece of paper and pencil, and I'd like you to write down 6 things that you like about yourself. The room became very quiet, and the pencils sort of stayed poised over the paper, and nothing happened. I mean, they were all sitting there like obedient sisters, but nobody was writing. So I thought, well, you know, I'll encourage them a little bit, you know. Nothing happened. Finally, this very dignified Mother Superior, who was still in full habit with rosary, etc., said, Mrs. Morris, I think you don't quite understand. We spend 1 hour every morning confessing our sins. Now, she said, if you would ask us to write down our weaknesses, I said, but I'm not asking you that. I said, I'm asking you to write down your strengths. Because how can you plan a future on your weaknesses? But I suddenly realized what a false sense of humility. And the room was just alive. Because they all knew what I was saying, and they, for the first time, it seemed, became aware of how terrible this was. To have been carefully trained to ignore their God-given gifts and talents in favor of reciting their sins. And I thought, my, where does this come from? But I can remember, and I bet everyone in the room can remember, especially if you were raised Scandinavian, that your parents very seldom said anything to you as long as you were on track, right? The only time you got strong comments was when you were off track. If you were doing the things you were supposed to do, they expected you to do it, and so that was fine. But you got a lot of attention when you were off track. And so you sort of got this idea that nobody really celebrated all your virtues, that in fact that wasn't even good manners, might even be vain, could even be pride. And so we were really reluctant to do this. And yet I find in my clients that I have to say to them, if you're in this kind of a point in your life, you must pick up and start thinking, what is trying to be born here? Well, this happens at each of these places, and I have to tell you that I'm quite convinced that the reason my aunt lived so well all those years was that she was able to relate very well to the fact that she had to change, because she started a college when she was in her 60s. And the year that she was 94, that the year that my mother wrote to me, she started a museum. And she traveled all over Europe by herself. She left Iceland and traveled all over Europe getting things for her museum. And this reporter in Copenhagen said, now why would you start a museum at the age of 94? And she looked at him like he wasn't too bright and said, because I didn't think of it earlier. And I had this vision of her going through another life crisis, you know, and deciding, now what? Who am I now, and what does the society need now? And what can I add to the mix at the age of 94? And she gets a whole new life script. She became an author when she was 100. And she wrote a column a week until she was 106. And at 106, I visited her, and it was great fun because I had this school teacher as a translator. And I said to her, you know, now, Aunt Haldora, my sisters and I have to leave now and go back to America. Is there anything you want to say? And she thought for a minute and then said something in very rapid Icelandic, and this school teacher just broke out laughing, just couldn't stand it. I finally had to sort of tug at him and get a translation out of him, and he said, well, her message to you is that she says that when she dies, she doesn't want to be buried in this small village. She wants to be taken to Reykjavik, where they have more interesting people. Mental image that she is still going through life transitions. And she's still thinking, now who am I? And what needs to be done? And what does the society require of me at this point? Because she was living a very vigorous, productive Christian life until the day she died. And I think this is a possibility for all of us if we don't feel as though the decisions we've made are the decisions we have to live with. Now, there is a sense in which we always live our commitments. I am not advocating that one ignores commitments, but there is a sense in which we are constantly aware of the changes within ourselves and the changes within our culture and the changes within our particular little area and saying, and now what, Lord? Now what? And I think that when you look at each of these transition periods, there's two things that you really have to look at very, very carefully, and one of them is the relationships, how we are changing in our relationships. And the other one is in our life work. And tonight I would like to talk a little bit about this whole area of changing relationships and the need to evaluate what's going on in our relationship life. Because that is without a doubt one of the major areas that has changed dramatically for us in the last couple of decades. What are some of the things that you can think about that have really changed, besides this business of living so much longer? What are some of the other changes that are happening in relationships in our
mobile society?
We're so terribly mobile, and what does this mean? You know, in terms of relationships.
Well, they change. They become estranged. A person you might know becomes a stranger after 5 years.
Yeah. Not only the fact that your children might grow up and live in other places, but also that people that were your friends leave, or you leave. And so these relationships are very often pulled apart. And it used to be that you could reasonably expect to stay with people through a lifetime. Except I have to laugh, you know, it's marvelous to go back to where you were raised to find out why your grandparents left the old country. If you really want to find out, you know, I found out that going to America was the way you got divorced. I discovered that some of my relations had solved their problems this way. And then I've been trying to figure out, did they get married again here, or am I the offspring of some unusual liaisons? But I think maybe if my mother said, why do you need to look into that? All right, I'll drop it. I'm very interested because, you know, we talk so much about now how terrible divorce is, and I certainly I'm not one that is happy to see anything like that, but at the same time, I do think in the olden days we had the courtesy to die or move to another country rather than go through divorce. People have always solved these relationship issues in some way or another. What else has happened?
Technology change.
Technology. So what has that done to us in terms of relationships?
A lot of it has forced mobility.
Yeah, so that people have to go where the jobs are, in a sense. And that's always been true to us to a degree, but I think it's happening more and more. And another thing that has happened is that technology is changing the way we work with our colleagues.
Well, we're machines.
Yeah, now we're interacting with machines. And I can't tell you how many people come to work, to come for counseling, who say, you know, Mrs. Morris, I'm making $39,000 on my job. But you have to be very, very well educated and smart to be able to get some of these technological jobs. But once you have them, and once you've mastered them, you then interact in a very repetitive way with this machine. And there is this alienation, this separation, this feeling that there is no psychological pay from the machine. The relationship is not there, and there's a kind of, an ennui, a sort of malaise. Yeah. And that's going to become more and more. We're going to talk a little bit about that more tomorrow. What other kind of things are happening to relationships?
We're living in a woman's world. There's more women than men.
As you get older, particularly, we end up. And this is a fascinating kind of thing, you know, because most women were raised to think that they wouldn't be happy without a man. And so then they find themselves with maybe 40 years without a man in their life. And so they're sort of surprised sometimes to find out they're still happy. Truly. I mean, this is a whole, women did not expect to be happy unless they had a partner. And, of course, while people would prefer to have partners, women are discovering that, in fact, there's another way of relating in the second half of life. So I think the age span to women living 7 years longer than men. And I keep thinking the men ought to notice this. How come they're so accepting of this discrepancy? This didn't used to be, you know. In 1850, the life expectancy was 40 for both men and women. By the time we got to 1900, it was up to 48 for both men and women. Because you see, women tended to die in childbirth, and men tended to die in dangerous occupations. And today, we've now got this 7-year gap between men's life expectancy and women's. Why do you think that is? Because it's not part of the scheme of things.
I think there's so much competition in a man's life, more so. And they're working harder and pushing themselves more and things. Many of them don't even reach the age of retirement, 65. And that's why you have so many younger women that are widows.
And I think this has something to do with relationships. This is what we're finding out, is that women have been allowed by our society to be more cooperative rather than competitive. And I think now that we're finding more women being pushed into sort of a way of relating to others and relating to the business world, that they are now being pushed into a more competitive stance. And of course, we're seeing some of the stress-related diseases coming up for women also. And we're finding that women don't necessarily have the same kind of gentle relationships that they used to have with each other, because they're not only becoming more competitive with the men, they're becoming more competitive with other women. And I really grieve about this, because I think that women had a way of relating that was more in keeping with the way we need to be for the future. I mean, I think competition simply isn't viable anymore. We simply can't think in terms of competition anymore, because it's not functional. And yet, just when women could have been teaching the society another way of living, they instead opt to go toward the dominant mode. And I think that is just unfortunate, because now we too can die of stress diseases. Instead of helping our men, not. So I think that's a very pertinent point. I think stress issues in our society have made a big difference. What I would like to do here is to hand out a worksheet here. It's not really, I'm going to have you do some things on the back, but it's basically to give you an idea about a way of looking at the relationships in our lives that might be useful to you. Could I ask you to pass it around a little while?
Sure.
If you need some more, I've got some. Concepts that I find is quite helpful for people when they are going through life change is to say to themselves, all right, if the question that I have to address is this basic question of who am I now, how do you tackle this issue of who am I? One of the issues that I mentioned was relationships, but I look at our lives in terms of at least three selves. And the first one I call the individual self. Over here is the relationship self, and over here is the life work self. And the, if you like philosophy, you might be able to look at these things and say the individual self, when you have to say, who am I, and you have to get to a sense of some kind of construct that you can tackle that issue, the individual self is the self as being. The relationship self is the reality that is between you and others. And this is rather a fragile self. Because while the individual self, if you call it self as being, this is the self that comes into the world alone and leaves alone. And in a very profound way, this is the self over which you have the most control. There's a sense in which you have to say, I am responsible for the self that carries through in a very profound way alone from the beginning to the end. But the relationship self is a very fragile kind of thing, because somebody else has to be there for you. Those of you who have been a fan, as I have, of Martin Buber through the years, and his sense of dialogue, the notion that there is no reality until somebody else is there for you, is both a marvelous thing, because it is without a doubt one of the great joys of our life, but it is also the area in which we are most vulnerable, because there is no reality there unless somebody else is both willing and able to be there for you. And for many of us, as we grow older, as we go through the different life stages, some of the people that we thought would be there for us aren't, because they can't, or because they don't want to be. But I can remember so clearly how men were often encouraged, in fact, to not see their life in this way, but to actually expect that most of their satisfaction was going to come from their work, and more, that they would be expecting to get a lot of their friendships and sense of relationship satisfactions from the people who were their colleagues and co-workers. So that many times when a man loses his job, he not only loses his tasks that he does, he loses a big part of his relationships, because many men have said to me, I don't have any real friends, Mrs. Morris. I have a lot of career contacts, a lot of people that I work with that have meant a lot to me. But if you take my job away, you not only take my job, you take my relationships. And they have tied those two together. On the other hand, many women have been encouraged by our culture to over-invest in relationships. We have really, as women, been taught that if we are going to be happy, it's going to be because of our relationships. And we have really bought into this, that if we were happy with the people in our lives, then we were happy. And with that kind of a schematic, it became very clear that we were extremely vulnerable.
because we couldn't control what other people did or what other people thought. And so I have found it very important that people start thinking, could I invest reasonably about a third of my life energies into simply growing and maturing as a person, and investing about a third of my energies into my relationships, and investing about a third of my energies into my work, to get sort of a sense of balancing these different parts of oneself. And then not only that, but to look at all these different sources of relationships where you can get satisfactions, relationship satisfactions. So that at no time are you so invested in one little piece here that if something happens, you are in a very dangerous and vulnerable position. In fact, if you are investing wisely here, and when I'm looking at the spiritual dimension here, by the way, I should explain to you that I see this in terms of time and energy and spiritual activities. The organizing principles or the values would be your belief system, which of course is at the heart of it all. But this is in terms of actual energy spent on activities, spiritual activities. But when I see the relationships, for instance, I find so many women that I have talked to who really thought that if they invested their whole life in relationships, that those relationships would pay off down the road a piece. And they're always shocked and distressed when they discover that it doesn't necessarily play out this way. Perhaps it's because you didn't look at the balanced concept too well. In fact, this woman came into my office one time. She was an absolute full sail. I mean, she was just furious. And as she came storming in the door, she said, "I have to tell you something," she said. "I have invested my whole life in my family." She said, "Whatever my family needed, I was willing, not only willing, but I was desperately wanting to do everything I could for my family." And she said, "I gave my whole life to my children." And she said, "And now one of them has moved to Connecticut, and one of them has moved to Florida, and the other one's in California." And she said, "And let me tell you something, they don't even write." And I sat there and I listened to this, and at a gut level, I knew why they had moved to Connecticut and Florida and California. Why? Because when you overinvest in something, you reasonably expect a return on investment. But the truth of the matter is that when you overinvest in something like that, you put a burden of payment on people that they can never pay back. And you know yourself that if you lend some money to some people and they can't pay you back, what do? When they see you coming? They dodge you, right? Absolutely. All right? If you give your whole life to somebody, they avoid you. Why? Because they don't know how to pay you back. Why? Because they can't. And yet, if that has been the kind of thing that you have been raised to think you should do, then as I interviewed these women on board ship, I got this real profound sense of betrayal, as though they felt they had been taught to live their life in one way, and in fact, it hadn't brought the kind of return they had expected. And I wanted to just put my arms around them and say, "My friend, it isn't that life has betrayed you, it was that your expectations were unreal. You need to be thinking about investing in many different parts of yourself. When you think that life rises and falls on relationships, you're just asking for trouble. And yet, it is such a beautiful part of life and such an exciting part of life, it is very seductive. And especially as we were raised as Christians, I'll never forget coming to another one of those little growing up points when, you know, click, click, in which I suddenly realized that I had been listening to the first half and not the second half, love your neighbor as yourself. But I had heard love your neighbor. And so I had been seeing my family as my neighbor, and I'd been seeing my neighbors as my neighbors, and I had been seeing all the people in our parish as my neighbors, but I had not been respecting me. I hadn't been investing in my own growth and development, and so I was feeling drained by my relationships because they kept needing and needing, and I kept trying to give and give, And because I hadn't been investing over here, and I hadn't been investing in a life work, a work that was really my work, then I simply didn't have the resources to be of great use to the people over here in my life. Besides which, I didn't have any, and I didn't really have much of a support system. I didn't even have much of anything except my husband and my four children in terms of day-to-day relationships. I didn't even have close friends because I was so busy with the needs of my family and the needs of the parish and the needs of other people that I literally did not nurture the giving relationships that would have fed me. And so pretty soon, there came a point of being drained. And I see this in helpers and givers, people who have been raised to be givers. They have not respected themselves enough. And at the heart of relationships is that you are in good shape. You have nothing to offer unless you're in good shape. And so now we discover that as we go through life stages, there are times when your family is absolutely number one. So when you're looking at the circles like this, yes, there are times in your life when the family really does require a tremendous amount of investment and time. But then you start getting into other life periods, and that in the natural scheme of things, the family will be moving because of the mobility. They will be getting onto their own life. They will be doing this and that. And then we have to start saying, do we have colleagues? Are there people that we work with on a team? Are there people that we work with in the community that become our colleagues? Because you don't need a paid job. You can have a marvelous life work without a paid job. I'm going to be talking about how to balance paid work and life work tomorrow, because I'm not all gung-ho on paid work at every stage of life. I think there are times when you need it. There are times when you don't need it. But we all need a life work. We need colleagues, co-workers, people who work with us on something that matters. And we also need profound, deep friendships. One of the things that I feel that in our very rapidly changing society, one of the things that has really been threatened is lifelong friendships. And yet, this is one of the relationships that stays to the end. The only thing I can remember, my mother lived to 88, and she said, Alina, it's time to go. And I said, I can sense that in you. And she said, all my friends are gone. And she said, I'm just totally dependent on you girls. And she said, I really miss my friends. And I think, you know, that is one of those things. Toffler talked about the fact that we have to learn how to make friends at every life stage. Because the people who could be really close friends to us at one stage in our life are not necessarily the people that will be our best friends in another life stage, because we change. And our circumstances change. But many of us were pretty good at making friends when we were younger. But then we didn't reach out and didn't work at cultivating friendships as we get older. And this is one of those things that we have to do if we're going to be able to keep a balance within this relationship life. I would just be interested to know, I don't exactly want any show and tell, but I would like to hear from some of you. How many of you are finding that it is harder today to make good friends?
You don't make any new friends when you're my age.
She's saying that when she's her age, you really don't make new friends. You're
not real friends.
Real friends.
Many acquaintances, many fine, lovely people.
Yes.
Real friends.
How many of you have experienced this? I hear this a lot.
I think that's very true.
Mm-hmm. I think it has been true. And I think that as people move from city to city, my sons who are going through that starting a new job stage, you know, they have finished college and now going into jobs. They're losing their friends, you know, that they had in college, and they're now moving into the workforce and don't know a soul, and they're finding it's very hard to build relationships again because people are willing to let them be sort of superficial acquaintances, but they're very close sometimes to risking good friendships.
Well, one of the hard things about that is in college, there are so many like people. It's real easy to make friends. They don't have the network because most people have left home. And there's a lot of people that are the same. When you get out in the workforce, people are so different that there are some people that you work with that you don't want to be friends with.
No, and many of them have their own circles well established, and so you're almost the outsider. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is a powerful transition period. And on one of the most profound dimensions is on this friendship business. Yeah, no, it is hard. But, you know, it was interesting for me to see that if I were to be teaching some classes here in the next decade, I think I could keep myself busy the whole decade on the subject of how to make friends. Why? Because I think it's a skill. It is something one has to learn, like riding a bicycle. There are ways to make friends. And I think that as we live longer and we keep a shifting locations and as we go through life transitions, one of the things we have to learn is how to keep this relationship life alive and well, and make friends. There are some marvelous books out, and the only thing I can suggest to you here is that you assume that you will be able to make very deep friendships at every stage in your life. But it will take hard work, and when we're younger, friendships come rather easily because everybody, as you say, is sort of in the same boat. They're sort of at the same stage of development. And so it's much easier. But what I am consciously doing as I go through my life stages is to make sure that I have some friends who are considerably older than I am, some friends that are in my age bracket, but I also make sure that I make some very good close friends of people who are at least 20 or 30 years younger than I am. And I literally reach out to them, I invite them to dinner, I make plans to go up to the cabin, I make plans to have barbecues up there. And I found myself the other day having a barbecue up in Kamado Island, and there wasn't anybody over the age of 31. And I didn't do it on purpose, but I suddenly realized, these are my friends. And I thought, isn't this fascinating? Because they weren't worried about age. And I didn't care. But it was because I was getting into some areas of work and technology in which my people my age weren't as interested as I am. And so the people who are interested in that tend to be around 30. And so I find that through my work, I can meet people who are like-minded, and the age doesn't matter. But I'm the one that has to reach out and really make these relationships. And in order to become a friend, and to make these new relationships, you have to be very vulnerable. You have to be willing to risk. In fact, if I had to come up with one word that is the critical word in each one of these life transitions, it would be risk. And nowhere is this more true than in relationships. That each time that you're going through one of these and you sense a period in your life ending and you're making that big leap into redesigning what you want your life to be in the next stage, you have to say, am I willing to get out there and risk? Am I willing to be rejected? Am I willing to be unappreciated? Am I willing to not have it come out even? Am I willing to invest and not worry about whether it comes back? Am I willing to reach out to people who are very unlike myself? Can I reach out to meet people who are of a different race, who are of a different age bracket, who are of a different political persuasion, who are of a different economic level? I think one of the terrible things that happens as we get older, we tend to only look at people who are like ourselves. And there's nothing more boring. I mean, you know what they're going to say before they say it, right? So that as we go through these life stages, there has to be this constant reaching out and saying, I want my relationship to consist of people I work with, people that I see as my support network, if you will, and friendships, and then I see my family, and I see my extended family. So that as your children move away, my daughter, who has been a great joy to me, just finished
graduate school now and is working back in Indianapolis. I frankly can't understand why anybody would want to work in Indianapolis. But at any rate, she is back there. And I am really missing her. But she has a friend of hers from the University of Washington who has no parents because they were killed in a plane crash a couple of years ago. So it occurred to me that this girl probably needed some parents in Seattle. And so suddenly now she has become a surrogate daughter. Instead of me, I mean, I was really feeling lonely. And I decided I can either be lonely or I can reach out to somebody else who needs parents in the Seattle area. And so it was a conscious, designed move. It didn't just happen. It was something I had to make happen. So I am really seeing that I was interested in our couple that was married for 33 years, and we were all singing to them. And last week I celebrated my 34th anniversary, and I congratulate you both. But I also think that the relationship has gone through many of these transitions, hasn't it? I think this is what is so fascinating, is that people who make it through all those years, I think, really say, this way of relating to each other has ended. Now what we have to do is find a new way of relating to each other because our lives have changed. Our life stage is different. How we perceive each other changes. So that in many ways you have to start a new life stage every so often, a new way of being married. Yeah, so even within the same relationship, the changes occur. My friends, I can see that our time is gone, and I appreciate your interest in this because I find it endlessly fascinating. And people are so exciting in their possibilities for growth and change. And the fact that you are interested in making your whole life live well, I think is a great sign that people care enough now to address these issues. And tomorrow night, I would like to address how to design life work until the day you die, how to be involved in significant work at every life stage. And that'll consist of both paid work and involvement that does not carry a price tag. Thank you.